All right, we're continuing in our series through difficult sayings, hard sayings, and tonight we're going to talk about the the young people, not so much in America or in Europe or Africa, but in Asia. We're going to talk about youth in Asia and what can be done to help them. We're going to talk about the concept of euthanasia, which is it comes from the Greek word meaning good death or happy death. The euthanasia is it's often used the putting to death, the killing of people who are whatever, fill in the blank, people who are elderly or people who are infirm, people who are struggling physically, sometimes just struggling emotionally, mentally. And so what do we as Christians, how are we to think about the quote-unquote right to die? You know, it's been a hot issue in our society. It's had times. We're going to talk about a particular issue tonight from about 15 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, that I don't know where it has left our nation as far as our general thinking on this issue. But we need to make sure that when we sculpt our thinking on any issue, we don't go to what popular society is, because it ebbs and flows. People change their mind. There's the shifting winds of culture all the time. And so we need to make sure that we go to God's word, which we'll do tonight, and see what God says about it. So there are two kinds of euthanasia. And one is active, often we can divide it this way. One is an active euthanasia and one is a passive euthanasia. Active is going to be like Jack Kevorkian style. You want to die? Come over here to my death chamber. I'll help you die today real fast. You know, and they administering certain drugs or whatever to hasten on the death. I want to list some reasons why some are in favor of this. So some say that it's a good thing for someone to be able to die on their own terms, for somebody to just be able to die right now if they want to. And it's basically, it's suicide. It's often called assisted suicide, that I don't want to commit suicide, but will you do it for me? Will you kill me? Well, I don't like, that sounds like you're murdering me. Will you help me die? You know, and people talk about it in different words and phraseology. But I want to give some reasons why some people are in favor of this, say that it's a good thing, and we'll also interact with the Bible, what the Bible has to say on some of these rationales, some of these ways of thinking. So, number one, some people favor euthanasia, this active euthanasia, because they believe that we have a moral right to die with dignity. That I don't want to struggle in my old age and go, you know, whatever, slobbering all over myself. I want to be able to retain my dignity, and I have that right, that moral right to die. There is no moral right to kill. Let's look at some verses about this very quickly. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 32, and then we'll look at Job chapter 1. While you're turning, I'll read Exodus 20:13, which simply says, one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. And I do know that there are some caveats to the word kill. The word means murder. It doesn't mean that we are never to kill. There is a time, capital punishment, when God says that if someone has shed man's blood, then his man shall be shed. His blood shall be shed by man, meaning the government, or before there was governmental authority, you know, it was kind of, there was called the revenger of blood. The closest family member was authorized to carry out capital punishment. So thou shalt not kill does not mean no killing at all, anytime, anywhere. There's war and so forth. There's self-defense. But murder is what we're talking about. And so look at Deuteronomy 32 and verse 39. Speaking of God, it says, see now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. We see here from this verse kind of the slant that God is the one who has the authority to give and to take life. And it's not ours to intervene in that process and say, I think I will take life here. I think I've determined that this person has lived long enough and I will step in and play God, so to speak. God says, I'm the one who kill, I make alive. And so it's kind of sitting in God's seat, playing God when someone kills, assists someone to die that's asking for it. Look at Job chapter 1 and verse 21. Job 1, verse 21. And then after this, we'll look at Hebrews chapter 9. Job 1, 21. So this is when, obviously, Job has started to go through all of his difficulties. He's lost all of his possessions and his family and so forth. Verse 21, it says this, and he said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job recognizes God as the one, again, with that authority to give, to take away. He's the one who determined when we were born and how we were born. And on the flip side, he's the one that has the right to determine when and how we die. It says that when I return thither, when I die, I will also be naked. I will have nothing. We're not going to take anything with us. And so God is the one. He gives, he takes away, and recognizes God as that author of life and death as well. Look at Hebrews 9 in verse 27. Hebrews 9, 27. It says, and as it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this, the judgment. And the thought goes on, but that's a truth about all humanity. It is appointed to us once to die, and then we stand before God at the judgment. And so it begs the question in that verse, who is the one that is doing the appointing? Who has set the appointment of when our death is? And so the answer to that is God. And by the way, God, I do know this, that God is all-knowing. God knows everything that we think and do before it happens. So it's never this, that God appointed for it to be here, but we decided it was going to be there, and we threw a monkey wrench into God's whole plan, and now the universe is going to fly apart. What's God going to do? You know, God knows if someone ever does this and takes life and takes matters into their own hands and kills, God knows that was going to happen. By the way, that does not release us to do anything. Oh, I can do anything I want, and God knew that was going to happen anyway, so I actually helped out God's ordained plan. That's the wrong way of thinking. Thou shalt not kill. And God is the one. We need to leave it to God in his appointings, in his timing. And it is many times beyond our understanding about how and why God does certain things, specifically with life and death. But it's God's prerogative, so to speak. He has the authority because he created life, and he has determined the dignity. He has set the dignity and the preciousness of life, and it's his to give and to take away, not ours. So someone might say they have a moral right to die with dignity, but that does not give them a moral right. That does not be able to transfer to someone else the moral right to take their life whenever they decide, whenever they determine. Here's another reason some people mention they believe that they have that the constitutional right of privacy, which by the way is in the 14th Amendment, that the constitutional right of privacy includes death with dignity. There's some people who will argue that I have the right to privacy. You're over there, I'm here with my life, and I have the right to that privacy, and so that gives me the right to have death with dignity. I get to choose how to die in my time and my terms. But the Constitution, again, does not give the right to kill. And the right to life, this is not necessarily a biblical argument here, but the right to life in the 5th and the 14th Amendment would take precedence over a right to privacy. A right to life is a higher principle to be defended than someone's right to privacy. Number three, here's another reason some favor it. Some people say that it is an act of mercy to the sufferer. Someone's getting old, someone's in ill health, someone is struggling, and they're suffering mercilessly. And so as an act of mercy to them, then they should be able to, someone should be able to kill them, help them to die fast or to die easily and well. This basically is kind of an end justifies the means type of rationale. It's a slippery slope that if it's okay to do that, then it opens the door to, you know, what other things. If someone else, if I determine, I think that person's suffering over there, I think he'll end their life. I don't like that. That's kind of bad. So let me just end this to override the bad and the whatever the greater common good that's accomplished. And so this idea of being merciful to someone, taking away their suffering. And by the way, and we've looked about this in 1 Peter a lot recently, but I want to look at some verses very quickly that show that there is much to be learned through suffering. Suffering is one of those buzzwords in our society. My dog just had this happen. It did? What happened? What happened? Did the dog suffer? Oh, it didn't suffer, did it? Oh, no, suffering. And people find out, you know, the so-and-so, they passed away. Oh, they did. Did they suffer at the end? You know, at this point, the person's dead. It really doesn't matter. I'm not trying to be crass here or unfeeling. But once someone's dead, it doesn't matter whether they suffered at the end before they died. No one is in heaven thinking, you know, I'm glad to be here, but I just really wish I hadn't suffered at the end of my life. That was awful. No one cares once they're dead. I'm not saying that doesn't matter how we treat them now because they won't care once they're dead. But so let's look at a couple of these verses that talk about God's plan in suffering. We often want to escape, minimize suffering at any cost, but sometimes we need to recognize that God has allowed it for a reason. And we're not always called to escape suffering. So look at James chapter 1, and then we'll look at Romans chapter 5. Again, we could look at several verses in 1 Peter, but we've done that recently. So James chapter 1, verse 2. And again, don't get me wrong as we look at these verses. It doesn't mean that I am for pain and suffering, and that if someone seems to be dying easily, we should say, hey, that's not fair. We need to make their suffering worse. You know, I'm not advocating for that at all. I'm not for suffering. But to hasten death fast to avoid suffering is not automatically God's will. So look at James 1, verse 2. It says, my brethren, count it all joy when ye fall into divers temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. I remember hearing a story one time that David Gibbs, the Christian lawyer and preacher, told about a woman. He was visiting a church, and a pastor took him to a hospital and was visiting a woman in the hospital. Her husband was a construction worker. One day, he was sitting in his, Christian family, Christian man. He was sitting in his semi-truck and reading his Bible there while he had dropped something off for delivery at a construction site, sitting there reading his Bible. He didn't know that high up above were steel beams that were being transported, and one cut loose and came down, went vertical, right down through the cab of the truck, directly where he was, and drove his body through the truck into the ground. And he died instantly, obviously. So this woman lost her husband. Shortly after that, we're talking within a couple of weeks, she was in a severe car accident. A drunk driver had hit her. And she was greatly injured. She has neck injuries and back injuries. All of her children in the car were killed. And she's in the hospital on her back, broken back. I'm not sure what else was wrong. But she's lost almost everything she has on this earth, Christian lady. And to anyone's knowledge, she hadn't been running from God. He wasn't trying to correct her. It was a guy who was kind of a Job type of situation. And the pastor took David Gibbs to visit this woman in the hospital, and he said, well, I'm just going to go and visit her and pray with her. And they came there, and David Gibbs said that when he saw her, he says, her face, her eye, you couldn't have taken your fists and made her eyes blacker than they were. She looked a total mess. And the pastor said, so-and-so, we've come, we just want to pray for you today. And the lady lit up when they walked in the room, had a big smile on her face, and says, oh no, I want to pray for you. And she says that God has given me so much joy here. I've been blessed so much in my life. And David Gibbs is thinking, how can this woman go through all that she's gone through and still have this kind of joy? And he learned, and many other, the nurses and other family members learned a lot through her suffering. And to just reach in and say, you know what, let's just end it all. God could use that in a great mighty way. And we try to take that staff, so to speak, God's rod and his staff to accomplish things. We want to take it out of God's hand and we want to do our own will. And we need to be sometimes just, you know, pray and ask God, what are you trying to accomplish? Because suffering is not automatically the worst thing. We've seen in 1 Peter and other places that suffering will magnify, if we take it well, if we do it for the glory of God, suffering will magnify heaven and our rewards in heaven. So we shouldn't automatically try to run away from it. And if we find out that someone's suffering, just end their life as fast as possible. Let's look at a couple of similar verses and we'll move on. Look at Romans 5 and verse 3. Romans 5 and verse 3. And we'll read 3 and 4. It says, and not only so, but we glory in tribulations also. The word glory means to boast in them or to rejoice in them. We glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and so forth and so on. So, opposite from running away from tribulations or trying to end them as fast as possible, God says that we can glory in tribulations, knowing what they accomplish in us, how they help us to grow and learn and shine God's light. Look at Job 23 and verse 10. We've already talked about Job briefly. Here's as he started off great. He sinned not with his lips. The Lord hath given, the Lord taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And then he struggled for a while. He sat there for 7 days without saying anything. His friends came and sat. They didn't say a word. And then he finally opened his mouth and he said he cursed his day. He wished he had never been born. He wished he had never faced all that he had gone through. So he struggled for a while. But then he comes back around to seeing the right perspective. And here's what he says in Job 23 and verse 10. It says, but he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Here's the thing that we don't always know. We don't know yet when God has tried us, when he's done. That means there, when he is done trying me, I will come forth as gold. And sometimes we say, you know what? I've had this long enough. I'm done. Well, God might not be done. And we need to yield to that and wait on the Lord and see what God does many times rather than escaping suffering. Look at one more verse about this. Hebrews 12 and verse 11. Hebrews 12, 11. I mentioned this verse, alluded to it this morning. I want to read it very quickly. It says, now no chastening. It doesn't say most or some. It says, no chastening. For the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. And that the word that jumps out to me in that verse is the word afterward. And we don't always know when it's going to turn a corner. We don't know, you know, we're in the tunnel and there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah, but is that a train coming to get me or is that escape? We don't always know when it's done. But sometimes we just have to keep waiting and be patient. And God will in his time. I like that song. You ever sing that song? In my time. In my time, you know, it's in his time. And we don't always know. I will say this. Rarely does our timetable match up with God's. Usually, God has us to go through things longer than we thought we should have or longer than we would have chosen. But we yield to him and we recognize that he is perfect. He knows what he's doing. You might think you're done and you're ready to move on. But what if God's waiting for something else in someone else's life to happen before, you know, we go to the next thing. And so we need to be aware of God's will in the whole thing. And we just, and sometimes people want to, as an act of mercy, or want to end someone's life to ease their suffering. But God might want to do great things through their suffering. This is not to minimize suffering, but from the eternal biblical perspective, there are worse things in the universe than temporary. By the way, any suffering we go through in this life is just temporary. There are worse things than temporary human suffering, namely, as we talked about this morning, eternal spiritual suffering and physical suffering in hell. And if we could go through temporary physical suffering well, and God would use that to save someone from eternal suffering, it was worth it a million times over. And so we need to be very careful about jumping out for ourselves or making the decision for someone else to just end things fast as an act of mercy. Okay, number four, another reason, we'll mention these other ones more briefly. This is similar, and sometimes people say, well, this is an act of mercy to the suffering family. Someone's loved one is dying, and they are in the bed, and it's just so awful for the family to watch them. So as an act of mercy to them, we'll help the person die fast so they don't have to go through that anymore. It's kind of a similar reasoning. Number five, a similar thing is sometimes people argue that it will relieve financial strain on a family. I mean, we're trying to keep this person alive. We don't even know if they're ever going to come to. We don't know what they're going to be like later. Is it going to be worth it? And so we're pumping, we're draining our savings dry. We're going to lose everything. Is it worth it to lose everything for this person when maybe if they're going to die eventually anyway? I mean, everybody dies, right? Might as well die now. Okay, with that reason, let's take you out the back and start with you. No. But many times people think it's better to save the money and put the money towards something else than keeping someone alive. Look at a good verse about, and this speaks to more than just this issue, speaks about any time you have a need for money and you're fretting, despairing, and if you're a Christian. Look at 2 Chronicles 25 and verse 9. Words of a prophet, man named Amaziah. Here's the scenario. There was a king that had hired, the king of Israel, who's hired an ungodly nation to help him fight a battle. And the prophet comes to him and says, you don't partner up with them. They're against me. I want you to send them all home. And he says, but I already paid them what I contracted them for. So I'm just going to lose all that money. And so here's the answer. 2 Chronicles 25, verse 9. And Amaziah said to the man of God, but what shall we do for the 100 talents which I have given to the army of Israel? And the man of God answered, the Lord is able to give thee much more than this. What a statement. Sometimes we think, oh, I got too much invested in something. I can't turn back now. God says, at any moment, it's not too late to turn back and do the right thing. And if you ever cut your losses, so to speak, and say, I am going to just lose what I did, and I'd rather just walk with God, God is able to replace all of that and more in a second if he wants to. Will he? I don't know. Tell me if he will, and then I'll decide if I'm going to let go. That's what we often want to know. But here's where we walk by faith. We do right over money. So many people, they choose money over right. They say, well, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. I can always go to God and ask forgiveness, but what I need right now is the money. God says, if you do right, I will take care of you. No good thing, Psalm 84:11, one of my favorite verses, no good thing will the Lord withhold from them that walk uprightly. If we just do right, God will provide everything that we need. And so that was a principle that Amaziah was trying to share with the king of Judah here. And that is one of the answers to this. What happens if all my life savings are going down the tube because we're trying to keep Aunt so-and-so or Grandma alive? God is able to give you more. If you honor God with your money, whether it's keeping someone alive or anything else, if you honor God with your money, you are not going to do without. God will see to it. He's not going to be anybody's debtor, and God will not say, oh, thanks for keeping her alive. Oh, I mean, I totally forgot. I'm sorry you didn't have enough to eat. God is going to take care of our needs. And so we need to do right. Number six, another reason people favor active euthanasia is that it relieves society of a great social burden. They're a drain on the system. We're pumping money into this. You know, we just need to drop off. And by the way, we see legislation in our society expanding further. This speaks to abortion. Sometimes people are going to be born with a disability. How severe is the disability before we shouldn't even keep that baby alive? How severe before we intervene over the parent's wishes and just decide the state has decided that this baby shouldn't be born? Or is some life worth more than others? Where do you draw the line? And so it's a very slippery slope that people go down. And then number seven, some people often say that it's the humane thing to do. And by the way, that word humane, what's in the word humane? Human. Our society likes to use the word humane and throw it around with animals and so forth. The Humane Society. What's a humane society? Did you know that when the Humane Society started, it was starting to keep people from drowning? Keep humans from drowning. It was devoted to that. And then somehow it got switched over to treating animals like humans. Anyway, for the humane treatment of animals. To treat animals, elevate them like they're on the level of humanity. And they're not. And I'm not an animal hater. But if we have to choose between a human and an animal, then I hate animals, if I put it that way. He just said it, Pastor said he hates animals. We always choose human life and we elevate that. And so some people say, well, it's just the humane thing to do, that when someone's suffering, just put them out of the misery. That's what they would do with an animal. Oh, if the horse breaks his leg, it's just humane to just put him down. But animals are not humans. And there is a sanctity of human life. There is so much that God can do emotionally and mentally and spiritually beyond the physical in human life. We need to recognize that. I want to mention now a couple of things about the other kind of euthanasia. That was active. Passive euthanasia. Passive euthanasia would be kind of defined as allowing death rather than producing death. Instead of killing someone that wants to die, this is now just allowing someone to die. And there's two kinds here. It divides itself into natural and unnatural passive euthanasia. So the natural would be the withholding of food, air, and water leading directly to death. So someone could survive if we were to help them, if we were to give them food and air and water, things that we all need. And natural passive euthanasia is to withhold that. I want to read a little bit about a story. I don't know if you heard about this case. It was a court case. It was court cases that lasted for about 7 years, 1998 to 2005. A lady by the name of Terry Schiavo. I don't know if you heard that name. I'll tell you a little bit of the backstory if you haven't heard it. When in 1990, I'm not sure how old she was at the time, this lady, Terry Schiavo, she was in St. Petersburg, Florida, in her home, and she collapsed in full cardiac arrest. And she suffered massive brain damage due to lack of oxygen. And she spent 2.5 months in a coma. And then after that, her diagnosis was elevated to a vegetative state. And she remained in that vegetative state from 1990 to 2005. For 15 years, she was in the hospital. And I'm not sure how much she was in other locations as well. She had a feeding tube keeping her alive. She was breathing on her own. I don't think she had respirators. I don't think she had oxygen, but she had a feeding tube and she could not feed herself. And while she was in this state, there's a battle between the lady's husband and her parents. And her husband wanted to pull the feeding tube out and just allow her to die. And her parents said, no, she's vegetative, but she could come back. We don't know, you know, exactly how she would be. So her parents wanted to keep her alive, and there were these legal battles that went all the way up. The low courts, middle courts, they went to the Supreme Court. President George Bush himself was personally involved. And let me read a couple of the things that they initially, 2001, so she had been for 11 years, in this state. 2001, her feeding tube was removed for the first time, only to be reinserted several days later. And then 4 years later, so this is the year she died, 2005, a Pinellas County judge ordered the removal of Terry Schiavo's feeding tube. Several appeals and federal government intervention followed. President Bush was on a trip. He returned early to Washington so that he could sign legislation to keep her alive, specifically. After all the attempts at appeals through the federal court system were upheld the decision to remove the feeding tube, the staff at the hospice facility disconnected the feeding tube. This is March 18th. And for the next, she died on March 31st, about 13, 14 days. Nobody, they just removed the feeding tube and nobody did anything to help her. Nobody, did anything. And they just allowed her to starve and die. And it took 14 days there. In all, the Schiavo case involved 14 appeals, numerous motions, petitions, and hearings in the Florida courts, 5 suits in federal district court, Florida legislation struck down by the Supreme Court of Florida, a subpoena by a congressional committee to qualify Schiavo for the witness protection, federal legislation, and 4 denials of certiorari from the Supreme Court of the United States, and it also became a high-profile case in the pro-life movement and disability rights groups. So it was a huge case, and I, by the way, don't know where our nation stands today as far as rule of precedent based on what happened then. But basically, they decided, we are not going to keep this person alive. A lot of people ask questions, where do you draw the line? Is it if someone can stay alive without a is it the respirator? If something is making their heart pump, is that artificial? And then we're trying to intervene and we should just let God's nature take its course. And by the way, there are arguments on a God level that you can make both ways. Sometimes people could say, well, if God wants her to die, then he can kill her beyond our attempts to keep her alive, right? And so we should try to keep the person alive and let God decide if she can die. People can flip it the other way and say, well, if God wants to keep her alive, then we're going to pull the tube. And if he really wants her to live, then he's going to intervene and do a miracle and keep her alive. And so people could throw it on God, both directions and arguments. Where should we draw the line in those cases? If it's a young person, if it's a baby who maybe has their whole life ahead of them, we should really try to save the life. But if it's an old person who has lived their life, we think, how long has someone lived before they've lived their life? You know, what should the life expect? Well, you've had enough life. You're done now. Back when the Social Security system was set up, you collect Social Security at 65. You know why? Because people died at 65 then. That was the life expectancy. They didn't expect you to live long in your Social Security. They expected you to just have a little pittance and then fade away a couple of months. And now people are living, life expectancy is around 80 in the United States. But if you've lived 80, there are people who live 90. There are people who live 100. There's people who live 110. Who's to say if you're 70, you've lived long enough? They could live another 40 years. That's a long time. What could they do in those 40 years? We cannot intervene and play God. I believe that we should always seek to preserve life, really, and it's hard to draw lines sometimes, but seek to preserve life at any cost and allow God to intervene and make decisions. Here's some parameters that someone mentioned that maybe are some guidelines with making decisions as far as whether or not to put someone on a life-sustaining machine. By the way, just that concept, a life-sustaining machine. Do you put someone on a life-sustaining machine where the machine is doing the living, so to speak? The machine is making the heart beat and pumping the blood. Sometimes that type of thing is unnecessary and later can create a new ethical dilemma about turning the machine off. Okay, we put you on the machine, and now when do we turn it off? I don't know. Sometimes just doing your best beyond the artificial, out of my depth really to know exactly what's artificial life or preserving of life and so forth. But here's some parameters that some have mentioned. One, the disease maybe should be irreversible. By the way, how do you know if a disease is irreversible? Is anything irreversible with God? God can take someone from, and I have heard of cases where someone was in a coma or a vegetative state for a long time, and then God brought them back to full health, and you never know when God can do that. There's nothing irreversible with God. But, you know, I don't know where to draw lines. We talk about chronic illnesses and so forth. Maybe a parameter should be that the patient has veto power. You know, someone can say, well, what do you think about this? We might do this. And the patient can say, no, I want to do this. And so they can veto your decision. Also, maybe sometimes a collective decision. I was involved one time with this. I've never had to make this decision with one of my family members. But several years ago, Sue Mahwinney's husband, Bill, had a fall and he ended up passing away. And there was that meeting, gathering of family members at the hospital, and Mrs. Mahwinney asked me if I would be there to help support or help decision making. I didn't want to intervene and make a decision for the family at all, but I was there, and you know, the doctor would talk through certain decisions, and it's a big question mark. People feel guilty, like, I don't want to be the one to make the decision to end someone's life prematurely if it's not God's will, and it can be a very difficult time. And so it can be an individual. I think, you know, families can talk about it. If you have a chance to talk about, Melanie has said to me, she's not here to defend herself, but we were just recently, you know, she has said to me that I don't want to live in a state where machines are keeping me alive, you know, or this type of existence. But it's hard to, we don't want to play God and step in and say, God might do this, but this is what I am going to say. That's a dangerous place to live. There are people in the Bible that were there. Jonah asked for God to kill him. God didn't. Saul asked for his armor bearer to kill him. Abimelech, he had an assisted suicide. He was hit by a stone someone threw on his head. He asked for someone to kill him, and they did. And there are times in life every single day around the world, in close, not just around the world, but close by, where people are right there. They're at the end of life, and what do we do? But we need to be very careful about playing God. God is the one who has the authority of life and death. He gives life. He takes it away. Do you pray that God would take someone quickly? I don't know how to pray sometimes even about that, but just pray for God's will, not my will, but thine be done. And just pray for God to use whatever life someone has for his glory, and that you can use opportunities to share the gospel. So it's an issue that is a hotbed issue in our society, particularly as it relates to euthanasia, as it relates to those that are born with disabilities and struggles there, as well as the elderly. And so it's something that we should think about before we're in the situation. Don't have to make it on the fly. Prepare our hearts for what I should think and what I should believe. All right, we're going to end there for tonight. I was going to get into another one, but for our sake of time, we will cut it short there. No pun intended. And let's close together in prayer.